In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about things that don't scale and why you should do them. This, ladies and gentlemen, is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 168. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
Well, we had a listener write in earlier this week named Dennis Hennessy, and he suggested that, or he was listening to the episode where we talked about some of the different apps we use, and I had mentioned that I was using Commit to make sure that I do certain things on a very regular basis. And he actually suggested that I try out GoalStreaks, and I really like GoalStreaks because I checked it out, and essentially the idea is that it's very similar to Commit, except that you can put in what are basically skip days, which I think would work out actually a little bit better for me because there are certain days of the week where I know that I'm not going to do those things. So for example, working out on Friday is just never going to happen. But Commit doesn't allow me to like put that in and say, no, I'm not going to do that. So I can't schedule those sorts of things. So I'm going to give it a shot and see how things go.
Very cool. Well, first of all, this is an iOS app. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then what kinds of things do you have in there? I guess working out is one.
So I have working out, I have writing, and then I also have working on AutoShark.
Good. So yeah, give GoalStreaks a try.
What about you? What are you up to this week?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised this week. We started selling MicroConf tickets to Micropreneur Academy members. They get a slight discount and then they get early access to the tickets before the general public. We sold out their allotment pretty quickly. And in fact, we got a few emails from Academy members wanting to buy kind of after all the tickets were gone. And so it looks to be a sold out crowd again this year. And by the time this airs, will likely, you know, already be sold out. But some tickets do become available. So if you're still interested in going to MicroConf, you can always go to microconf.com and click on, you know, the ticket link. We tend to have a pretty hefty wait list. And if you get in that early, you do have a high likelihood of getting contacted because we have some tickets that become available as the conference approaches. And then the other thing I've been up to, my wife right now is on her two-day annual retreat, and I'm gearing up for mine here in about 2 weeks. And that's where I go off and don't check email and look at my goals for the year, figure out, you know, really verify that those are the things I want to do, and then map out as closely as I can over the course of 2 days exactly how I'm going to achieve them and figure out what it's going to take on a monthly or a quarterly basis and basically set up my game plan. And the reason I do this, I've talked about it before, but it's because I like pursuing too many things. And so once this list is locked, I will do almost nothing else that is not on this list for the next year. And that's the only way I've found that I've been able to stick to things and grow them without wandering all over the place as the next new fun idea comes my way. So needless to say, I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to the quiet time, the thinking time, and really getting down to business in 2014.
I've been working on AutoShark and talking to a few different customers, getting some ideas about what their needs are for moving forward with the product. It looks like I've got a little bit more work to do. There's a couple of demos that I'm trying to schedule, but in order to actually do those demos, there's a few more features that I need to implement because I know that there are things that they've basically already told me that these are things that they need. So in an effort to kind of make the demo align very well with what their needs are, then I've got a little bit more work to do on the product to make sure that it can do those things before I show it off to them. But the demos are for more in the enterprise space. So I'm really hoping that those go well. But, you know, again, I mean, I think that it can definitely go the route of software plus services to make those things work. So I'm pretty excited about it and just kind of looking forward to banging out some of that code and seeing what comes out of those demos. How are things working with Drip?
Drip's going good. I've really started diving in heavy to paid acquisition. And just in the learning phase, as usual, I'm pretty impatient with things. And I don't know how many months it's going to take for me to find the Drip flywheel, but certainly haven't found it in the past, what, maybe 7-8 days since I started. And yet I'm already wondering why I haven't. They're just trial and error at this point. Dig it into the marketing plan, have a bunch of different things going on. An ebook it's already been written. It's being designed. I'm working on an infographic, have a bunch of blog posts in the hopper, you know, stuff that's just things that I'm going to be experimenting with. But really over the past 7 to 10 days, I wrote some long form sales copy, cranked out several variations of landing pages, and I'm basically testing those against the traffic that I'm able to generate via the various advertising venues. Today, we're going to be talking about doing things that don't scale. And this phrase has been bandied about quite a bit. I think Paul Graham, since he has the largest kind of platform, he wrote an essay on it in July of 2013, so about 7 months ago. The interesting thing is Paul Graham has such a larger view, right? Because he invests in hundreds of companies, and he thinks very critically about this stuff. The first time I've read this, because I've heard about this essay for, you know, the last 7 months since it came out, but the first time I read it was preparing the outline for the interview, and I was surprised at how many things, not just the title of Do Things That Don't Scale, but how many specific things in his essay aligned directly with things that we've said in the past on the podcast. So that was kind of a nice confirmation that when multiple scientists do multiple experiments and they all arrive at the same results, it's multiple confirmation that this theory may at least be more correct than the things people have been saying for the 100 years before that. And so that's the idea here, is that multiple people coming up with things independently helps reinforce it and makes me believe that these things are not just our thoughts or our opinions, but they're actually things that multiple experts are starting to embrace. So I think to kick us off, we have 7 things that you should do that don't scale. And to kick us off before that, there's a little intro piece I want to bring up. And Paul kind of tacked this on to the end of the episode, but he says that people should start thinking of startups as two-dimensional objects instead of just one dimension. And what he means by that is most people think of a startup as an idea. It's what you're going to build. He says the idea of doing things that don't scale is so important that we need to start thinking of startups as two-dimensional objects. Basically, the first dimension is what you're going to build, and the second is the unscalable things you're going to do to get that company going. Now, what that means is that when you come up with a startup idea, he's saying that's incomplete. That's not actually a full-fledged startup idea, that you actually need not just a product idea, but the plan to get those initial 100 users or whatever it's going to take to kind of get you out of the Earth's atmosphere and into orbit. And I thought that was a kind of a fascinating thought, that he thinks this concept of unscalable things is so powerful that he's actually saying that a startup idea is incomplete unless you've thought those early days through.
Well, we've talked about that as well, though. I mean, and we didn't phrase it as like a two-dimensional thing, but we've also talked about it and saying, so there's the idea itself. And the second is, how are you going to bring it to market? How are you going to get in touch with your target customer base? And in a lot of ways, that is, in order to do that, you have to do those things that don't scale.
Very good. So let's dive in. Our first point of 7 is to recruit users manually. So Paul Graham says that the most common unscalable thing founders have to do is recruit users manually. Nearly all startups have to. You can't wait for users to come to you. You have to go out and get them. And then he gives a few examples, Stripe, Airbnb, and a couple others. Well, it lines up with 2 phases of stuff I've talked about recently with Drip. There was that initial phase of just vetting the idea where I emailed 17 founders and I got 11 go-aheads of, yes, I would buy this. I mean, that was a very manual user recruiting process. And then the second part of it, where once I had a launch list, in the end, it was about 3,500 emails, and I basically handpicked some early users and started inviting them in, but it was that slow launch, right? It was the heavy onboarding, heavy customer development time of basically walking users manually through your app, manually onboarding them, finding out what they like, don't like, if they're going to stick around, and if not, why not? I view that a lot as relating to this concept that he's saying about recruiting users manually.
Well, I think there's a couple of different things there. I mean, you in the early days, you really have to do that, because if you just set up a website and you have people sign up and you don't really know anything about them, what you're essentially doing is you're basically taking a stab in the dark at what resonates with people, and you don't get any of that feedback. And they may come to your site and they just leave and you have absolutely no idea why. Versus if you start a mailing list and you get people, you kind of give them like a 1 or 2 sentence description of what it is that you're building, or you're talking to people and you're getting them invested in it as well, that you get to close that feedback loop. So it's no longer this open loop system where it's just you're hitting the gas and you've got no idea whether you're going in the right direction or not. And I think that that's really the important part here, is that you have to be able to get that feedback loop closed so that you understand about what direction it is that you're going in.
The next point that Paul Graham makes is, he basically says, expect your startup to be fragile in the early days. He says the question to ask about an early stage startup is not, is this company going to take over the world? But the question is, how big could this company get if the founders did things right? And he brings up Microsoft as an example. And he says, Microsoft can't have seemed very impressive when it was a couple guys in Albuquerque writing basic interpreters for a market of a few thousand hobbyists. But in retrospect, that was the optimal path to dominating microcomputer software. And then he also brings up the Airbnb founders and how early on they were just manually taking professional photos of their first host's apartment and that they were just trying to survive. And so you couldn't see them taking over the world at that point. It was very fragile. And it was basically a 30-day swing where he says going out and engaging with users was the difference between Airbnb taking off and completely failing.
I think this thought from Paul comes from a little bit of a different perspective than, you know, kind of where we come from, because most of the stuff that we talk about, generally speaking, a lot of the people that I talk to and interact with tend to be starting stuff on the side. So this idea of like a 30-day swing before you go out of business just isn't there, because we don't have investors to account to. Yes, there's those few people who decide that they're going to burn the bridges behind them, quit their job, and they've got 6 or 9 months worth of money in the bank, and that's it. But that is probably the exception rather than the rule. So I think to, you know, people like us, this is a lot less of an issue than it is for like funded companies where they've got to get to a certain point and they have a very, very tight timeline to do it or they're toast.
Yeah, I'd agree. This one doesn't apply as much to bootstrappers. The piece of this that I do think applies is I would change the word fragile to unstable. And what I mean by that is that in the early days, as you're recruiting users, trying to turn them into customers, trying to retain them, you just don't have enough information to have any kind of stability in your metrics, or even it, like confidence in your sales process, confidence in your user retention, confidence even at sometimes, unfortunately, in your app. Bottom line is, if you've launched and you're in the first 60 or 90 days and a customer emails and says, wow, there's a major bug and there was a, you know, some issue when I clicked a button and did this, if you're in the first few months of your app, you really don't know if you've introduced a bug. If your app's been running for years and it's mature and all this stuff, you know that there's stability there. But I would say expect instability in the early days and expect a lot of uncertainty when there's any type of challenge. You know, if someone says, oh, your pricing's too high, that creates uncertainty because suddenly you're like, oh man, is my pricing too high? You just don't know yet. Once you're successful and once you have a lot of people using it, you know that your pricing's fine. You know, if anything, it's probably too low. The other thing that I've seen is in the early days of Drip, someone emailed and said, oh, I would totally try this out, but you're asking for credit card up front. You shouldn't do that. And then, you know, tells me why I shouldn't do that. Now, I know that I want to ask for credit card up front for a bunch of reasons and for, you know, all my trial and error with all my apps. This is how I'm going to start. And yet at that moment, the uncertainty and kind of the instability of that moment made me question and think, oh, should I take the credit card wall down? You know, and I had to think about it. And of course, I didn't, because I went back to all the research and the data that I have on this and decided not to. And I actually asked someone in my mastermind and he told me I was crazy for thinking about it. You know, instead of thinking about fragility, I think it's more like instability and uncertainty is something that you should anticipate, especially in those early days.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten already, I mean, I've gotten people saying that the pricing of Audit Shark is too high for them. And for some of them, it's just like, well, you know, I look at their situation, I'm like, you're really not in my target market. But then there's other people who kind of are, and I'm like, it definitely does make you think about it, and does give you that level of uncertainty about whether or not you're doing the right thing. And then part of it's just because there isn't this giant history of customers or people that I've interacted with to be able to say one way or the other.
Paul's third point is about delighting early customers. And he says, you should take extraordinary measures not just to acquire users, but also to make them happy. And he says this whole concept of doing things manually to delight early users is counterintuitive for founders. And then he gives three reasons why that is. One, he says, is because a lot of founders are trained as engineers and customer service is not part of our training as engineers. Another is that we worry that it won't scale. And then the third is that we've never received attention like that from other companies. And so we just don't feel like it's something that you can do or should do as a business. Because, you know, frankly, when you go into the Sprint store or call Verizon customer service, you're not going to see that kind of service. So naturally, we think that it's not something that we need to do off the bat.
I agree that I think that this is not something that is widespread, but I've seen it before. I've seen companies do it before, and it makes an impression. And I'll give you an example. When I signed up for MailChimp, after I had sent one of my first campaigns and made a payment with them, they sent me an email and said, hey, we've got a special gift for you. Click here. And I clicked there, and I went to a page, and it opened up just a form that I was supposed to fill out where I put in my name, address, and everything else, and then they would send me something. They sent me a MailChimp t-shirt. That kind of gave me the idea to do something similar for Audit Shark, and that's something that I have kind of down the road. But I definitely wouldn't say that those types of things couldn't scale, because I think one of the examples he uses is Wufoo sending each new user a handwritten thank you note. I think that if you start acquiring 1,000 customers a week, sure, that's not going to scale as well, but you can certainly, like if you're sending people t-shirts, for example, there are services that you can integrate with where they will print the t-shirts and send them, and really all you need to do is give them an XML data feed that says, hey, send this t-shirt here, and here's our information that says who to charge it to. There are ways to make other things scale, but there's definitely things that you can do that surprise and delight your customers that would not, and I think it's just a matter of choosing the right things that will.
Yeah, I think delighting early customers ties back in with a lot of the manual onboarding stuff we've talked about. I do like the idea of t-shirts. I've been doing that with Hittail. With certain users, when they hit a milestone, they get it. Also, if people blog about it, they get a Hittail t-shirt. Drip, if you get your first conversion, you get an email that says, roll out the red carpet. Your first subscriber converted to a paying customer, right? Because you can set up a goal in Drip and you can see when they convert. And then we give them a link to a form where they can get a t-shirt. So that stuff does scale pretty easily. Once the t-shirts are printed, it's just like slapping an address label on it. So I think all that rolls into it. Another piece of this, and this is a little further down the essay, but Paul Graham says, over-engaging with early users is not just a permissible technique for getting growth rolling. For most successful startups, it's a necessary part of the feedback loop that makes the product good. Making a better mousetrap is not an atomic operation. Even if you start the way most successful startups have, by building something you need yourself, the first thing you build is never quite right. And so his conjecture is that you need those early users to give you feedback on how to improve it. The fourth point we have from Paul Graham is to start in a niche. And he actually has an odd subheading for this. He calls it fire because he says it's like keeping a fire contained before you go horizontal. But this actually lines up with the very fundamentals of the micropreneur approach. What's funny is he uses Facebook as the example of starting in a niche because it was a Harvard student network, and then it was a university student network, and then it went to everyone. I think more in terms of B2B startups, right? So I think of like Kissmetrics and how they really started as SaaS metrics back in the day. And now they're much more all web metrics and analytics. Another example that's happening right now is Drip. Drip has started in the kind of the SaaS and software space. And we're building out some features that are going to move us more broader into like the email marketing space. It's more become a marketing automation tool where you can move people to and from different lists based on their behavior. That is, it's not completed yet, but that's kind of in the works right now. And in the next couple of weeks, we'll be rolling that out. BidSketch is another example I can think of. Ruben's app, he started, you remember when BidSketch was proposal software made for designers? Well, that for designers went away a long time ago because there were just so many consultants in a number of niches and designers and developers and all types of people are using it. And so he eventually went horizontal and opened up his market. But what that niche allows you to do is it allows you to take advantage of those early niche things, like the fact that the market's small, that you can outmarket everyone else in the niche, that you can provide a tool that is so good just for that group of people that you can beat out a broader horizontal product. And so obviously this is one that I definitely agree with. And especially with a startup that doesn't have early funding, I don't know how else you would do it. I don't know many, if any, horizontal startups that come out guns blazing without funding at their backs.
I think this is one of those things that for people who are launching something on the side, they have this idea in their head that if they make it too small or if they go after too small of a thing, then they're not going to be able to get enough customers to support what it is that they're doing. And the other challenge that kind of goes hand in hand with that is that when you start thinking of a product and then you go through the process of building it, you always have these grand plans for what it's eventually going to become. And it's incredibly time consuming to make those plans come to fruition. But at the same time, you're always thinking in the back of your head, oh, I want to do this and I want to do this and I want to do this. And because of that, your scope tends to, you end up with a lot of scope creep in your product. it starts making it larger and larger, and you take more and more time to develop it as opposed to taking it to market and really nailing it for one small group of people. This is something that I've struggled with Audit Shark, because I have thoughts and plans for the product, you know, 3, 5, 8 years down the road that I know are going to take a very, very long time to implement. And I've got to focus on today, not 5 years down the road. And it kind of sucks because I can only do so much in the next 2 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever. But they're in the back of my mind, I always have these thoughts about, oh, what am I going to do for X when X is really something that's not going to be implemented for probably another 3 years.
The fifth point that Paul makes about doing things that don't scale is about consulting. And he says, sometimes we advise founders of B2B startups to take over engagement to an extreme and to pick a single user and act as if they were consultants building something just for that one user. The initial user serves as the form for your mold. Keep tweaking till you fit their needs perfectly, and you'll usually find you've made something other users want too. I have a bit of a tough time with this one. I think it's dangerous unless you really know that customer number one and you know that they have a clear vision of what they need and that you somehow have other inputs in, especially if it's a domain that you don't understand or that you're not familiar with. Taking direction from just a single client, I think, could be pretty dangerous and could get you into a pigeonhole where you're basically, you've built a super specific app for a single client and one that doesn't generalize to other people. And then the second side of that is that just validating that there is a market for it, right? Because finding that one person or one company needs an app is really not enough. You have to go out and verify that that need expands, you know, into a full-fledged market. And that's something I would definitely do before taking this consulting approach.
Yeah, I think the consultant approach can definitely work if you have a product and you have knowledge of that particular space where you already know the space. It's not that you're trying to validate a market or anything, you know, do an MVP. Like, you know that there's money to be had there and you know what types of products are going to be successful. The problem that you have is maybe cash flow or something like that, or you don't have enough of the product built to be able to sell it as a standalone product, so you essentially need to couple some services with it. That's the place where I see consulting working really well. But if you're still trying to validate the market because you don't necessarily understand it and it's not someplace that you've worked before, I think that this really starts to fall apart because it's going to be hit or miss depending on the company that you end up working with.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other thing he points out, and I think it's kind of cool with this consulting, he says, another consulting-like technique for recruiting initially lukewarm users is to use your software on their behalf. His startup that he sold back in the 90s was called VioWeb, and it was an early shopping cart software. And he says, when we approached merchants asking if they wanted to use our software to make online stores, some said no, but they let us make one for them. Now, this is concierge, right? I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, is essentially a free concierge service to get everything set up and to go beyond and do really manual things that don't scale to get those early users involved. And if you show them that they're success, then hopefully they'll stick around with you. And I love this quote. He says, we felt pretty lame at the time. Instead of organizing big strategic e-commerce partnerships, we were trying to sell luggage and pens and men's shirts. But in retrospect, it was exactly the right thing to do because it taught us how it would feel to merchants to use our software. The sixth point that Paul brings up is he calls it manual. And he says, there's an extreme variant where you don't even write software. You just do all the manual legwork behind it. I've called this human automation. I talked about it in my book. We've talked about it on the podcast in terms of if I were to launch something like Hittail, I would just do manual keyword research and manually email reports back to someone instead of having any type of software do it. And frankly, probably hire a VA to do it as well. I think that if at all possible, that's how you start a startup. That's how you vet that there is in fact a need. And you can get so much information out of working with customers without writing a line of code. And without spending any time, you know, if you're not a developer, finding a developer. And so that by the time you do, in fact, go to find a developer, you have so much more information, not only about what you want to build, but you have the validation that this is, in fact, going to work and that you can get money from people for it. And that, you know, that it provides enough value that you're willing to do the cash outlay or the time outlay to go and build it yourself.
I think one thing to keep in mind about that is that it's really about vetting the idea. It's about testing your hypotheses. And that's really what Lean Startup is about as well. I mean, it's doing that MVP. And the reason you do an MVP is because you don't know what the answer is. And if you don't know what the answer is, then you have to figure out a way to test it. And what's the least amount of work that you can do to test that? And this really falls under that umbrella. But, you know, again, it goes back to the idea that, like, if you know that there's money there and you don't necessarily need to prove it to yourself, then building software might be the right thing to do, especially if you already know how to solve those problems.
The seventh and final point that we took away from Paul's essay is that the big launch usually doesn't work, and neither do partnerships. This one made me pretty happy when I read it. I mean, he's basically saying the TechCrunch launch doesn't work, and I'm sitting there squealing with glee because we've said this so many times, and then I get halfway down and he says, partnerships too usually don't work. They don't work for startups in general, but they especially don't work as a way to get growth started. It's a common mistake among inexperienced founders to believe that a partnership with a big company will be their break. 6 months later, they're all saying the same thing. That was way more work than we expected, and we ended up getting practically nothing out of it. I've run into this a number of times, and this is why these days partnerships are last on my list for growing things, unless I know the founder, unless I know that they have a lot of customers and experience and they're going to be easy to work with. I would almost never partner with a much larger and impersonal, you know, Fortune 500 company as a way to try to stem growth. The partnerships that have worked for me have typically been when I've gone and sought them out and when I actually have something to offer. So I already have a large enough customer base that I'm able to cold email or try to get a warm introduction to a founder or someone high up in another organization, but it tends to be a smaller organization. Even if it's a multi-million dollar in sales organization, it's still run by one or two decision makers, and there's not a big group at the top where it's, you know, it's all corporate. I can talk to a single person and they can make a decision as to whether or not we want to do a joint mailing or whether or not we want to do an integration and promote it to everyone or one of these things. I mean, these are the partnership things that I'm thinking about that I've seen win. And unless they bring a lot of traffic and or existing paying customers to the table, it's almost never worth pursuing.
I think if you look back at the growth curves for, I would say, probably any successful company, there's very few where you can look at their growth curve and you see these giant spikes in there from pretty much anything. I mean, you'll see these gradual curves where things start to work and they figure them out and then they double down on them. And, if, you know, you get what's called the hockey stick growth curve. But there's never a hockey stick growth curve that I've ever seen where things will be going along and then suddenly they like vault up like by a magnitude of 3 to 5 and then they level out again. And that just doesn't happen. The great big launch, as you said, it doesn't really work. It helps you get customers, but it's more of a gradual thing. It helps get things started. And the same thing with partnerships. They will help get things started. I think with partnerships, there's so much work and so much effort involved that early on, it's just not worth the time and effort.
Yeah, this is why with Drip, I didn't go for a big launch. Really didn't get mentioned via many press outlets the day that the Drip launched, but I'd been marketing it for, what, maybe 10 months before that. And during that 10 months, it was building up the email launch list, right? And then gradually doing that slow launch over 90 days was almost the opposite of the big TechCrunch launch where you want to get mentioned on, you know, on Mashable and the Next Web and TechCrunch and 20 other places all in that one day. But that creates A, a lot of headache. B, it's a huge time investment to try to work with all those venues. It's kind of a crazy thing. People's sites go down because they get linked to by so many things. If you haven't already spent time onboarding and figuring out if your software even works and if it's going to retain people, you can get, let's say, get 100,000 uniques in 2 days and everybody poof goes away. Then what do you have? You know, you don't have any assets after that because you haven't built up something over a longer term. Suffice to say that I agree with Paul's assertion here that the big launch usually doesn't work and neither do partnerships.
Well, the other thing about that is that if you do get that giant influx of traffic, as you said, even if you get a bunch of signups out of it, you don't really know what to offer them next. And you don't know how to capitalize on those people who did visit but didn't sign up to bring them back. I think Joel Spolsky at one point had a blog article where he put it out there where if you have this giant launch and tons of people come and they look at your app and they say that it sucks, then they'll never come back. And that's going to be a big problem, especially if you try to make a huge splash in the market about an app that, quite frankly, is really still in the very, very early stages. So that gradual build up over time is the better approach anyway. I mean, you don't want to go too big too fast, because with any given startup, if you grow too fast in too many directions, there's several directions that you kind of have to grow in. But if you grow in a way that is skewed in one direction, and it goes much, much further than any of the others. So let's say that your revenue scales much, much faster than the number of employees. Well, you're going to have some serious growing pains because you have to grow quickly, which means you're going to have to drop your standards to bring people on faster. Bringing in too much traffic all at once is very similar. You're not going to be able to capitalize on that in a way that is going to be effective for your business long term.
So to recap, the 7 points we pulled out of Paul Graham's essay, Do Things That Don't Scale, are number one, recruit users manually. Number two, expect to be fragile or unstable, as we put it. Number three, delight early customers. Number four, start in a niche. Number five, consult. Number six, try human automation. And number seven, the big launch usually doesn't work, and neither do partnerships.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.